Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is longtime successful gambler Jake Jacobs, who happens to be Richard's brother. About a month ago, we aired a show where we spoke to Jake about his new book, The Battered Butterfly, and asked questions about his gambling career in blackjack and poker. Today, we're primarily going to be talking about his career as a backgammon player. Tonight's show is being pre-taped, as both Richard and I will be taking some time out of town, so for this reason, we're not doing our regular commercials tonight because we don't know when exactly this show will air. We thank our sponsors at the South Point Casino, the Palms Casino, and videopoker.com for their support of the radio show and their understanding. We received an email addressed to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com concerning playing at various Las Vegas Caesars Entertainment properties in the same day. Perhaps staying at Planet Hollywood, but throughout the day, playing a few hands at Paris, Caesar's Palace, Link, and maybe the Flamingo. The emailer wanted to know whether this would totally screw up his average daily theoretical, so maybe he should play without a card. So when the question came in, it wasn't specifically about video poker, but since that's really all I know anything about, I'm going to assume we are talking video poker. So my first comment is, why on earth would you want to do this? The games at these casinos are very tight. The only intelligent reason to play them that I can see is that if you've received an excellent offer and you need to play a certain amount to generate similar offers in the future, playing extra hands has negative expected value. If you want to play for fun, go to one of the local casinos where you'll find much, much looser games to play. But be that as it may, if you really, really want to play at several different Caesars properties on the same day with the least penalty, start and end at the same place. That is, play some hands at Planet Hollywood at the beginning of the day, go to each of the other hands and play what you want, but before you go to bed at night, play some more hands at Planet Hollywood. Now, there's nothing unique about Planet Hollywood. You can start and end at any of the properties as long as you start and end at the same property. The last time I tried this, it worked fine. But that was several months ago, and Caesars Entertainment changes things all the time. So that's how I would do it.
Yeah, I just want to mention that my understanding is I'm assuming that the person who wrote the email is not a very big player. And it sounds like they want to take a walk down the strip and stop at various places and maybe do a little playing. And I agree to start and end at the same place. If you are a big enough player where you're going to try to get your airfare reimbursed, that would be a very bad strategy. If they're going to come out of pocket for airfare, they want your play to all be there at the place where they're going to be reimbursing you. So, but, you know, if you're a casual player and you're just out trying to have a good time, then, yeah, I think you Bob's advice is good.
All right. Now, our guest tonight is Jake Jacobs, and he was on about a month ago. So, Richard, a month ago, we let you introduce him, and seeing as how you've known him for a long, long time, and since we haven't had any emails in protest of your introduction last time, why don't you introduce him again tonight?
All right. Jake is a one of the world's top backgammon players, perennially on the list of the Giant 32. He's written a couple of backgammon books and writes a regular column for Gammon Village. He's also an ex-professional blackjack player. Jake, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
Hi.
All right. I want to start off this segment by telling about the one and only time I ever remember meeting Jake. And this was more than 30 years ago. There was an important backgammon tournament at the Cavendish West Club. Now, that was in West Hollywood, which is right next to L.A., Los Angeles. I was a decent, not great, club-level player there. But since I could write better than many of the others, I helped draft the rules for this event. Now, the finals came down to Joe Russell and Jake. Joe Russell was a strong player, later became world champion at backgammon. I had never seen Jake before, but I heard he was a good player from Las Vegas. Joe was one of the best players locally. So there was someone acting as a bookie who was willing to take either side at 6-5, meaning you put up $120 to win $100.
Wow, how do I get that job? 6-5 both ways? I mean, 11-10 is bad, but 6-5.
This was a captive audience, and at this time, 30 years ago, I didn't know a whole lot about books, but I knew Joe Russell was a good player, and all I knew about Jake is he kept twirling this twig, and that didn't sound like he could. Any good player would twirl a twig, so I bet $48 on Joe to win. So now at the Cavendish, there was a world-class cheater named Gabby Horowitz who hung out there. So the rules we came up with were partly to combat the shenanigans Gabby had pulled over the years. One of the rules was that you rolled your dice from a cup with a lip on it so the lip would catch the dice and make them tumble and hence come up randomly. And both dice had to land flat on the right side of your board, and both had to hit the board at approximately the same time. Gabby had shown us that he could actually shake only one die, and while it was landing, would surreptitiously place the other die flat on a number that was good for him. We didn't want any such cheating in the big tournament. So, during the finals, nearing the end of one of the games, Joe vigorously shook his dice, rolled them, and threw them out. But one of the dice caught up on the lip of the cup, and it tumbled it out noticeably later than the other one. So, it was a worse-than-average roll for Jake. It wasn't a disaster. And on
for
this,
Joe, you mean?
Yeah, excuse me. It wasn't a disaster for Joe, but it could lead to awkward things the next hand. So it was worse than average. So Joe asked for a ruling. And so all of us looking at the game looked around at each other like, who's going to give this ruling? And I'd help write the rules, but I didn't want any part of a ruling. And so I thought I would cleverly try to disqualify myself by announcing that I had money on Joe, but it wouldn't affect my ruling, and gave Jake the chance to disqualify me because I had money on Joe. Jake said, fine with me, I trust you. Fool that he was. So I ruled that Joe got to roll over again, which seemed like the right decision at the time, still does. So now, 30 years later, I have Jake on the radio with me, hoping he hasn't been holding a grudge for 30 years for ruling against his interest. So, Jake, do you remember any part of this?
No, honestly, I don't. Because, you know, this isn't the kind of thing that would really concern me. And I, you know, I played some bridge. And, of course, in bridge, you trust the director if anything comes up. And I tell backgammon players, young backgammon players, this: look, you know, if there's any kind of problem, even experienced backgammon players, this, don't quote the rules. You may know the rules, but don't quote them. You just call the director, or let the director rule, and that's it. Now, that said, in backgammon, most directors don't receive training, whereas in bridge they do. So results may vary. But the other thing about it, you know, this was the first finals of a major tournament that I'd been in. You know, the prize money was up in the thousands of dollars. And so, you know, I'd won lots of club tournaments, but I'd never been in the finals of a tournament this big. And when I am in, you know, this kind of event, I mean, at that level, I really try to completely empty myself of emotion so that if things happen, you know, if I'd like to think that if I were down 14 to nothing in a 15-point match, that I would still be maintaining the same equanimity that I had at the beginning of the match before the first roll came out of the cups. And I can get close to that on those matches, you know. So
do you find though that there are certain players that it's much harder to get close to that?
Yeah, there are players that are annoying, but you know, again, there aren't too many people who would deliberately try to needle me in a match like that. I've known other people that have run into that, but I don't seem to, you know, provoke that kind of opponent.
I just remember in backgammon that there were just some players that just drove me up the wall. Not like that they were trying to needle me, just like their
well, an ongoing problem, and it's been, I think, dealt with in the last years as clocks have been adopted, is slow play.
Yeah.
There are players that play very, very slowly, and some of them clearly would try to take advantage of it. Mac Ballard played in the semifinals of what was called a world championship. It's not the one in Monte Carlo, but it was in Las Vegas. In fact, actually, it was the week after that Cavendish tournament. And he played a guy that was deliberately playing slowly and was holding up. He was playing in the beginner and the amateur and the world championship all at the same time. So he was holding up three different tournaments. And the farthest that he went was in the world championship, go figure. And he got to the semifinals. He's playing NAC. They sat down to play a 17-point match at 9 o'clock at night. And some of Mac's friends said, you know, are you going to have the directors monitor this guy? Because he would spend, you know, a minute or two playing an opening 3-1.
Which is the easiest play in backgammon.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's a play that should take 3 seconds.
Yes.
And you know, he would do things like he'd pause and take drinks of water and mop himself with this filthy handkerchief. And so the match took, you know, Mac said he didn't want him to know that anything he was doing was getting on his nerves. So he didn't call for a monitor, and the match took 8.5 hours. And then Mac had to play at 10 o'clock in the morning. He won the match. That was justice. He had to play one of the best players extant at 10 o'clock in the morning on Newgraph for $30,000. And he played and he won the world championship. But I did have one match with a slow player that got to me. And I didn't do anything during the match, but this fellow had obsessive-compulsive disorder. And he had these rituals that involved his water glasses and his wine glasses and the pitchers that he was using. And he'd pour water from the pitcher to one glass and then from that glass to another glass. And, you know, he'd pour the wine from the bottle into a glass and pour it into a different glass. And, you know, just all these and he'd massage all the checkers. And yep. So even though the match was clocked, and I had insisted that it be clocked, and he was upset about that, but it was a Bronstein clock. So there was a certain amount of time on the clock every round. You had X number of seconds, I think it was 12 seconds, before your clock started counting down. And, So the match took 3 hours, and it started at 1 o'clock in the morning. It was a 7-point match, and then he also was taking all these bathroom breaks because he'd been drinking. He was on his third bottle of wine, and who knows how many pitchers of water. And everybody in the room was staying up to watch this because it was such a train wreck. And at one point, he went to the bathroom, and there was this old lady, about 80 years old. I don't know who she was, but she came up to me, and she said, "And that was my opponent. I punched him in the nose."
You're reminding me why I quit backgammon.
You're reminding me why I don't play poker.
I mentioned that I'm a poker player. I'm not a poker player. I don't care for the game myself.
Now, when I played, different players played differently. So some of the top players back when I played, like Paul McGreal or Nick Ballard or Mike Svobotny, all excellent players, but if you saw a game, you would know which one of them played it because they had kind of a different style. Now, yeah. This was before products such as Jellyfish and Snowy and certain other computerized models came out. And so now I would think most of the good players would try to play like a computer. And so anybody who had a style would be, that meant you had a systematic mistake you were making in your play. Now, is this something you agree with or disagree with?
No, I agree. In the old days, especially, I think, you know, the divide, you'd find the players that had come up out of, you know, maybe playing at home, and if they were, if they had a Middle Eastern or Mediterranean background, they tended to play a safer style, whereas a lot of the books that were written in the 1970s emphasized, you know, this very, very bold style with a lot of hitting and a lot of blots. And it turned out that, you know, the best play is really a blend of the two. But, you know, you'd find players that played too safe. You'd find players that played too boldly. And you'd find players that they had one type of game plan that they favored over another. They like to play a back game, or they really like to go for primes, or they like to blitz. And, you know, you could see from their style what they were trying to do. Now, with the advent of very, very sophisticated bots, people play with the bots, and they pick up the style of the bot, and the objective is to, you know, get dinged for fewer and fewer errors, to minimize your error rate, which by definition means that you're playing in a manner that the bot approves of. And it's hard to justify playing in any different style because, you know, the bots just play better than people.
So the best players are the bots now, like all Correct. The other games, like chess,
yeah.
et cetera.
That's been true for a long time, yeah.
All right. Now, you write for Gammon Village Magazine. It's an online publication where you show readers about half the article for free and then tell them you can subscribe if you want to read the rest of the article. Now, are these new articles or are they recycled ones from the past?
No, these are new articles. And actually, when you say you, it's of course Gammon Village that does that. I write an article a month. And in fact, I just sent them my latest article about 2 days ago, and it's an article about the tournament that took place in Japan a couple of weeks ago. I'm giving them fresh material every month.
Okay.
And as far as that would be true not just for me, but I think for everybody else. But the articles stay up there, so that somebody who's subscribed and go back to the archives.
Now, you can get a lifetime subscription to these things for $125, which is the best value. Now, it is the best value if you are committed to churning out articles for a long, long time. If you're going to quit in January, $125 seems a bit steep. Now, what are your intentions about publishing back on articles for Gammon Village?
Well, again, let me say that, it's not really you, it's them. I'm a hired gun. And they have a lot of people writing. So even if I were to stop writing tomorrow, they've still got Steve Sachs, and they've got Doug Zare, and they've got, they had a terrific writer. My erstwhile co-author, Walter Trice, was doing a series of articles that led to his book Back in the Boot Camp, and he died. So he stopped writing, but the site goes on.
And his articles are still there. So if you want to get back into backgammon, Bob, you could.
Well, when I was playing at the Cavendish back in the
70s and 80s, Steve Sachs barely turned 21, and he was his mother had been a regular at the Cavendish for a long time, but Steve was brand new, and so I actually haven't seen Steve in about 30 years, and I'm glad to see that he's still doing well.
He became quite a good player. He's...
Yeah, when you were at the time of the ruling, I think Steve was only 19 then. I could be wrong, but you know, certainly Ricky was a manager of the club at the time, and Steve was there at that tournament. And when we left the tournament, you know, it was kind of funny. The Plimpton Cup was the next week, and this was going to be the last time that Joe Russell and I would be able to play because we had just made the finals of the Cavendish. And, you know, of course, it was a home tournament for us because it was Vegas. But I had my roommate then, Peter Wagner, and Mac Ballard was at that Cavendish tournament, and his girlfriend, Lorian, and Steve Sachs had asked if he could hitch a ride, and then Munchkin was coming back. And all of us at the backgammon tournament, you know, I just won second place. I had, you know, probably $5,000-$6,000 in my pocket, and, you know, Mac was carrying money, Peter was carrying money, Steve was certainly carrying something for, you know, entry for the Vegas tournament. And Munchkin was living in L.A., and he had a lot of bankroll cash from his blackjack bankroll that had accumulated. So after the Cavendish tournament, we stopped by Munchkin's apartment and picked up, he had 40 grand. And so between us, we had about $55,000. But it's a long drive back to Vegas, and people were hungry. And Steve said, oh, he said, I know a place that's open. And he took us to this Thai restaurant in the middle of Hollywood. And Hollywood 30 years ago, it was all, you know, junkies and degenerates. And,
well,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, it was a very, very dangerous place. And, you know, here we are with, all our luggage in the car and, you know, we're carrying all this money. And
I remember this restaurant was at Hollywood and Wilton, basically, and yeah, it was not a good neighborhood. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and that's about the only thing I remember about that backgammon tournament was being in that restaurant with all that money, and just being pretty paranoid about it.
All right,
well, now, Steve, a second. Steve, you know, Steve played for years, and when the bots came along, he studied very hard, and eventually it just clicked. And he became one of the top players. He is one of the top players. And he writes some nice articles, and, you know, he's an excellent, excellent player. But when you talk about slow play, I actually wrote an article, a couple of articles about Steve's play, because before it all gelled, he was one of the most brutally slow players in the game. And, I mean, this is going back quite a few years now, but he has the record. I was watching Kent Goulding, who I understand you've had on the show.
Yes, we've had KG.
It was a special event that Hugh Sconyers had helped develop hypergammon at this Las Vegas tournament. And Kent was in the semifinals of the hypergammon event. And he took a break, and I got up from kibitzing this match, and there was this big crowd gathered around, and I looked, and it was the finals of the Masters jackpot. And there's Steve staring at a four cube. And on the other side of the table, there's Kit Woolsey and Hal Heinrich, the Canadian world champion, is sitting next to him. And somebody, as I walked up, they turned to me and they said, he's been thinking about that cube for 40 minutes. I say, what? And apparently, it was a very, very easy cube. The only thing is that, you know, if he lost, he could possibly get gammoned. He could lose an eight-point game. And psychologically, you know, losing 8 points in the finals of a big money event like this might be, you know, somewhat devastating. But otherwise, you know, if this was just a, you know, money game and somebody offered you this cube on two, you wouldn't think twice about it. You'd snap it up. So the only consideration was, oh, my God, I could lose 8 points, and then I'd be down 13 to 5 and you know, next day or 13-3, and, you know, it's a 17-point match, and I might never come back from that, blah, blah, blah. So he spent 55 minutes looking at this cube. 55 minutes before he finally took the cube. And he lost 4 points, but went on to lose the match. But, yeah, so that was the all-time record, as far as I know. 55 minutes, one double decision.
There ought to be a law.
Now, one of the nice things about playing backgammon in the 1970s is that there were several women players who believed their chances would improve if they could distract their male opponents. So they wore loose-cut, low-cut blouses and going braless. And so former world champion Lee Ganoude actually wrote about this technique in her book called, surprisingly enough, Lee Ganoude's Backgammon Book. At that time, of course, I was 40 years younger, single, and horny all the time. So I didn't mind if all the ladies used this strategy in order to take advantage of me. For the good old days. So that happened a lot in Los Angeles. Did that happen in Vegas, too, in the clubs?
I didn't run into it so much myself. Occasionally, you know, a woman would have a low-cut dress on. But a friend of mine, he was an older guy, and he was a kind of an intermediate player. And he went to a big tournament years ago, and he'd gone there with his family. And he usually, at the time, he played for dollars. But before the tournament, this woman spotted him and grabbed him and said, "Oh, you want to play?" And he said, "Oh, sure, okay." And she said, "You want to play for fives?" Which was a lot more than he played for. And the woman was Susie Cream Cheese, the one that's immortalized on the first Mothers of Invention album. She was an avid backgammon player. And so his family came down and they said, "Sarge, you know, it's time to go to dinner." And they looked at the score sheet and he was up 20 points. And they said, "What are you playing for?" And he said, "Fives, $5 a point." And they were, "Oh my God, Daddy's up $100. And so he said, "Okay, I'll be just half an hour. I have to give her a few extra games, you know, just to give her a chance to, you know, make a comeback." And so he came to the dinner half an hour later, and they said, "Well, how much do you win? How much do you win?" And he said, "No, I broke even." And they said, "What do you mean you broke even?" And he said, "Well, every time I looked up, she had another button unbuttoned, and next thing I know, I lost it all back."
So. The Vegas backgammon scene in the late 70s and 80s was actually quite a bizarre place. But yeah, Susie Cream Cheese, I had forgotten all about her, but she was a regular at the Sunday night backgammon tournaments in Las Vegas.
But now, I did have something come up one time. I was playing McGrill, and
Paul McGrill, world champion, wrote one of the very best, the earliest and best books on backgammon.
Yes, indeed. X-22 himself. And we were playing in Vegas, and there was a big match. It was in the Super Jackpot. And I don't know whether I should say the fellow's name, because usually when this story comes up, he's hidden thoroughly behind a pseudonym. But anyway, I'll call him Mr. S. And Mr. S was kibitzing the match. And in walked Brian the magician, and Mr. S was the fellow who had lost $100,000 to Brian on a bet involving breast implants. Brian had gotten, you know, a pair of 38Cs implanted and kept them for a year and won $100,000.
Yeah, we've been trying to get Brian on the show for 2 years and haven't been able to yet.
Well, Brian had not long before he had gotten married, and you know, he had become a proud father of this baby girl. And so he had brought the infant with him. And when he went over to talk to Mr. S, a couple of women made a beeline because, you know, babies are babe magnets. And, you know, "Oh, can I hold your baby?" And the woman that picked this baby up was well endowed and had this V-neck sweater that was kind of a deep V. And when she picked the baby up, the baby hooked its hand right in the V and started tugging. And it was tugging away. And everybody, except McGrill, whose back was turned to the action, everybody else is staring, wondering just how far, how successful this baby will be in, you know, getting at what it obviously was trying to get at. And then Brian said, "Oh, you like those, don't you? Yeah, they're just like Daddy's."
Yes. Good.
So, Actually, you know, we'd exchanged some email before the show, and I think, you know, that some interest was expressed in a certain other bet that also involved Mr. S. So do you want me to tell the story about the weight bet a little bit? As much as I can tell. I mean, I can't.
Yeah, actually, because let me just preface that by saying that the idea of these weight bets has come up a lot. There are a lot. I at one point said we could probably do a whole show on weight loss bets, but this is one of the best stories. So, yeah, why don't you go ahead and tell it?
Okay, well, a couple of years ago, I was at the Japan Backgammon Tournament, which I try to get to every year, and I met a guy, I'll call him Mr. K. And Mr. K is a very, very wealthy individual, sometime backgammon player, lives in Japan. And we got together at this faux English pub for drinks. We were going to dinner at the world's best sushi restaurant, and it's not the one that you've seen in the movies. There's a place called Sushi Saito, and that's really the best sushi restaurant. And Saito it used to be hidden away, where one way to get there was through a parking lot behind a security desk, through an unmarked doorway into this narrow little hall, and then there was this restaurant that all you could see with the curtains, and you'd go in and it would seat seven people, and that was Saito. But it turned out that there was a back way, because this musty, dusty English pub with, you know, Japanese businessmen having drinks. When Mr. K and I got done with our beers and decided it was time for the 9 o'clock seating, we went through the pub's broom closet. And if you go through the broom closet, there was a doorway into that same hall. So that was the back way to Saito. And we got there, and nobody else was there. And the other five players were all supposed to be coming from the tournament hotel. And it turned out that, and this is the one guy whose name has been publicized because of this New Yorker article that came later, Falafel, who's one of the world's best backgammon players, was slowing up the parade because Falafel at the time weighed 308 pounds. So he was walking slowly. And what? He was late, and Mr. K was kind of upset because he's a regular psycho, and you just don't show up late for that kind of restaurant. So, at the time, Falafel had a roommate who I think in the New Yorker profile was known as the Lobster. And the Lobster weighed 138 pounds, 170 pounds less than Falafel. So, Kay called up Mr. S and said, you know, this was the next day, and he was talking about you know, this and that, and somewhere along the line, he was the one who came up with the idea for this bet. And he said, what do you think the odds would be? And S said, 50 to 1. And he said, oh, really? He said, well, I tell you what, I'll bet $10,000. And then he called back the next day, and he said, you really think it's 50 to 1? And S said, oh, you know, I've done these, I did a bet with Howard Lederer and Huck Seed. He said, I think the real odds are, you know, probably about 50,000 to 1.
Wait, you haven't said what the bet was.
The bet was that they would cross weights within 1 year. That, the one would gain, the other would lose, and that they'd manage to cross weights.
So one guy's going to go up from 138, and the other guy's going to go down from 308. And and if they cross, S is going to pay 50 to 1.
Which is $500,000.
Except at this point, now Kay says, tell you what, let's double it, make it 20,000 so that if you lose, you're going to lose $1 million.
Uh-huh.
Now, we can all understand why Falafel would want to lose weight, but why would a guy who weighs 138 want to gain weight?
Well, at this point, Mr. Kay contacted them. And I don't think I'm at liberty to tell them exactly what he offered them, but he offered them a free roll, so that, you know, if they did it, they would get a chunk of his bet, and there was no consequence if they failed, but they would be well compensated if they succeeded. And then Falafel said, well, you know, but obviously I'm going to need a trainer. You know, I'm going to, he asked for expenses. And, you know, frankly, I think he was going to save as much as, you know, he put in a claim. It was up in five figures for his expenses. You know, I think he probably saved that much money in food bills. But be that as it may. So they started out, and, you know, the lobster had trouble gaining. And this is the downfall of most of these weight bets. It's very, very hard to put on weight if you're not naturally inclined to put on weight. So Falafel was, you know, busy dropping, and, you know, next thing you know, he's lost 30 pounds, and, you know, a month or two later, he's lost 60 pounds.
And he wasn't allowed to get surgery, right?
Well, I don't know that that came up, but no, probably not. The long and the short of it was that they were going off to a tournament. By now, 10 months had passed. So it's summer, they're in New York City, and they weren't roommates anymore, but they were together in New York City. And they went over to the Russian Baths, which I think gave Falafel, you know, a last chance to do some sweating. And they had a weigh-in at the Russian Baths, and there's a picture of the two of them wearing their Russian Bath t-shirts. And in 9.5 months, Falafel had dropped 130 pounds. He weighed in at 178 exactly. And he looked, you know, he looked like a concentration camp victim at this point. I mean, he just, you know, 178 shouldn't, but, you know, on Falafel would look, you know, it looked awfully skinny. And in the meantime, the lobster didn't look like he had gained any weight, but he had been doing everything he could to bulk up. You know, he had been lifting weights and eating protein shakes and lots of donuts. And so he made it, 178 and a half pounds. So they crossed weights by half a pound.
Wow.
And was Mr. S there to witness the weigh-in? And
Well, the Mr. S would have known a lot of the people that were there to witness the weigh-in. So I don't think there was any question as to whether they'd done it or not. It was, you know, all parties seemed to have agreed that, you know, it was done.
Wow. I had a good weight loss story, but I ain't going to tell it now. It pales next to that one. So let's change the subject.
By the way, I think you know, within a month, Falafel was back. You know, he had gained like 30 pounds, and he might be pushing up close to 300 again by now.
Uh huh. Well, there's room for another $500,000 bet. Okay, now. In the good old days, there used to be a lot of cheating at backgammon.
Yeah, that's what made them good, the good old days?
The good old days for me is I was 40 years younger. So I had a lot of, I didn't have as much money then, but everything else I had more of. So now there were some magnetic dice rolls. There were slipping a Mickey into somebody's drink in the world championships. There was... a lot of good kind of stories like that. Is backgammon policed any better today than it was back in the 70s?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, at that time, actually, it probably hit its nadir in the early 80s. Around the time, you know, I had come in second at the Cavendish, and then I won the first Nevada State Championship. And then I really stopped playing because the two places that were the worst. One was L.A., of course. You had this nexus with Gabby, and you had Steve and Ron Chronister, and, you know, this group. It just seemed to be a spreading circle. And then there were guys in Chicago that were also over on the dark side.
And you had Max in Las Vegas.
Yeah, well, Max was friends with the Chicago group, certainly, and you know, and supposedly what happened was there was a restaurant owner in Chicago and Max and a player, a friend of mine from St. Louis, said that he overheard them through, you know, through his hotel room wall talking about how, despite the fact that they were using ace deuce dice, that, you know, they weren't winning as much as they thought. And this went into one of Danny Kleinman's books. Danny, you know, had devoted himself to exposing a lot of these people. And
he got beat up bad.
Everybody knows they did it. I mean, it's certainly never been proved, but they never denied it. But the restaurant owner later, he started playing in New York and plays for high stakes in New York, and people play with him, but they just keep an eye on, but yeah, he was using loaded dice that would produce a lot of aces and deuces.
Which at some parts of the game are very bad numbers. If it's late in the game and you're trying to
bad for racing, but great for hitting shots.
So. Yes.
Yeah.
So could he?
Yeah, and the more that the dice get shaken and rolled, and in a bear off, people tend to shake the dice hard and roll them hard, and so they were more likely to come up ace and deuce. Whereas the guys that knew that they were ace deuce dice, when they wanted a more random shake, they tend to plop their dice out.
Uh-huh. So, very good.
But now the when you mentioned slipping the Mickey, yeah, that was Mike Sankevitz at the Monte Carlo was given something that made him very, very ill. And I think he actually had to go to the hospital.
Yeah, he was taken out on a stretcher, yeah.
Yeah.
So the person I heard accused of doing that was a Vegas player. I don't have any proof that who we...
Oh, I thought that was Gabby that did it.
Oh, I thought it was Max.
Oh.
No, I thought it was a friend of...
Clearly we have great proof here.
Well, the good thing is both Gabby and Max are dead, so...
I didn't know Gabby died. I knew he was incapacitated.
Oh, I thought he was dead.
He was shot in the head with a bullet, I guess is the way you do get shot in the head. But and so he's incapacitated. Yeah. But I don't know if he actually – he might have died. I had not heard.
Yeah, but I know I had heard that it was somebody that was connected to a famous player from Israel. It was a famous player from Israel years ago. There were a couple of brothers in Israel that had sort of – questionable reputations. They were considered very, very strong players, but might have been over on the dark side. And I thought that I'd heard that this was somebody connected to them, friend of theirs.
All right. Now, Munchkin is your younger brother, but he got into gambling before you did, and he's been very successful at gambling in the Hall of Fame. Now, does having a younger brother being successful make it easier or tougher for you to succeed in the same field?
Well, actually, it makes it easier, but when it came to backgammon, he was playing in the early 1970s, and we were pretty competitive. We played games like hearts and spades, and, I thought, why should I get into a game where he's got such a big head start? So I avoided learning backgammon, and when I started playing, it was a complete accident that I played the game at all. And by the time I did start to play, he was living in Las Vegas. He had been away from Chicago for a couple of years, so it probably kept me out of the game. But then once I did start to play, there were open doors for people that were good players that mentored me later, took an interest in my game.
Yeah, I think in pretty much in any business, I think it helps to have people in the business
contacts.
Yeah. I mean, it's much easier to learn to be a professional gambler from, like, in other words, if somebody were going to come out and try to make it a living as a video poker player, obviously, if it was someone related to you, they would have a huge advantage over someone who was just going to pick up a book and try to.
Well, good.
Yeah, I mentioned on the last show that I went out to play blackjack because Munchkin called me up one night and said he knew somebody putting together a team, and my later blackjack career, because I played for about 3 years and then went back to Chicago and was not playing at all. I was managing a video store, and I got a call from Munchkin. He said, "Do you want to go to Korea? All expenses paid." And, you'll get, so much an hour, win or lose. And I said, yeah, sure. And so that was what got me back into blackjack. And it was also Munchkin called up. Apparently, he'd been on the phone with Bill Benner one time, and Bill said, "Do we know anybody with a good memory?" And Munch said, "Yeah, Jake." And that was how I wound up going out to Atlantic City and playing for the Highland team, was to play the memory game. And again, that was something that he had gotten me hooked up.
Actually, that memory game was one of the more complicated plays I've heard of. Why don't you explain what that involved?
Yeah, well, Bill had been ace tracking, and he discovered that this particular dealer that was in the baccarat pit at Harrah's had this very unusual move that we called clumping. It only happens with experienced dealers. They develop a move where when they go to riffle the cards, their hands get out of sync, and they do it consistently. And so they're dropping one side before the other one kicks in. And so what was happening was he was dropping 15 or 20 cards before he'd start dropping, from the other side. And so it turned out that the first hand out of the shoe, or the first, 20 cards out of the shoe would not get shuffled. And they knew that there was no way that they were going to be able to smuggle a computer into the baccarat pit at Harrah's by then. The magic shoes were burned out, and the stand behind game, just wasn't going to work in a place like the baccarat pit. But here was this this dealer with this incredible move. So they came up with the way it worked was this: I'd be playing, and when I actually made the play, I had this woman with me, and this was one of Bill's great perverted ideas. He figured that having a statuesque blonde with a low-cut dress, that the bosses had seen that before. So instead, what he did was he had me hooked up with this woman that was about 30 years older than I was, and looked like a housewife. And so Anita and I went in, and and she would play three hands of 500, and I'd play a couple hands of 1,000 on that the first round of the shoe. And so she'd be eating cards at 500, 500 a hand. And then that first hand would come out, and we'd get, make sure that the layout was covered with cards. And we'd have people that had, read the Harry and Lorraine system that would come by, and they'd memorize. And then we had different people, so it wasn't the same person every time. They'd come by, they'd memorize the layout. They'd run to the house phone, and they'd call upstairs to the suite, and they'd say, "Okay, here it is," and they'd give the run on the cards.
Like 8-2-3-7 face king, like that.
With the suits.
In baccarat.
No, the baccarat pit. It's baccarat blackjack.
Pit. It is blackjack. Oh, okay.
It was blackjack. Yeah. So yeah, they'd give the whole layout. Now, meantime, what I was doing was memorizing only the first two cards. Cards and suit. So they come up and they give the layout, and then it would get called over. We had an apartment called the Sweat Lodge over at the Ritz, which is where Lucky Johnson used to live back in the 20s. If you watch Boardwalk Empire, that was the real Lucky had a suite there too. Probably not our room, not the Sweat Lodge, but that was home base. So they'd call it back there, and there was a computer back there, and the hand would get input, and the computer would work out. There were 9 possible strategies. The zero strategy was, okay, nothing you do was going to help, so just bet the minimum. But otherwise, a one code meant play one hand of basic strategy, 2 meant 2 hands of basic, 3 was 3 hands of basic, 4 was 1 hand of anti-basic, where you flip everything around the other way, and you'd hit stiff hands against dealer small cards, but stand against high cards, so 2 hands, 3 hands, and then 7, 8, 9 it was dealer mimic. You'd play the dealer's basic strategy, so that it was a lot of options. Then the computer would work out what would maximize your win, and then it would generate a 10-digit code, which would be sent to a pager company up in New York City. So in the meantime, the you play for two, and come the shuffle, I get a call from the pager, and we had actually built up my pocket so that the pager would be visible, but I was wearing a sports coat. I had this really cheap watch, because I normally don't wear a watch, so I had this, $1 watch that they bought on the boardwalk, and during every shuffle, at some point about halfway through the shuffle, I'd look at my watch, and I had this move down where when I'd look at the watch, it would push my coat back just enough so that I'd be looking straight down into the built-up pocket, looking at the top of the pager. And there'd be a 10-digit number in there. And the idea was that the first digit was card number 3 in the string. In other words, I'd seen the first 2 key cards. So if that's all I saw, then the next card was going to be the 3rd card, and I would play the first digit. If I had seen 2 key cards plus 1, then I'd play the 2nd digit, whatever that was, and et cetera. So I'd have to memorize the 10-digit number, and now the new shoe would start. So I have to memorize the new 2 key cards, and I'd have to be keeping track of the previous 2 key cards, and I'd be remembering the 10-digit number. So after Anita had eaten cards for about a deck or so, I'd say, okay, I feel lucky, let me play, and I'd be playing one hand at a time. And then, when I saw the key cards, now I'd have to figure out where in the string I was. And then the next hand, I'd play, that many hands of $5,000. So that was the theory, but there was something that made this a little bit more, a couple things that made this more complicated.
Well, I'm not sure more complicated is what we need on the radio, but the interesting thing is you were able to do this successfully.
Yeah, it's hard to understand. Just
to do it, but here's the thing: the night that I did it, the guy was a relief dealer, so I had to chase him all over the pit, trying to to time it so that I could go there and tell the bosses, okay, we want to play on this table now. Give us a $500 minimum, and then half the time, the timing would be off, and we'd miss. And with all that, I only managed to generate, because we kept track of how many lock winners we got. So I generated 38,500 in lock winners. And after deducting expenses, the theoretical net for the play was 20 grand. The actual result was minus 17. Now, that's counting everybody, the other players, everybody's action, my practice sessions, the whole schmear. The only other person who ever managed to do this had the guy on the table for 8 hours straight. And, he wasn't a relief dealer. He was on the table, and Mike Mihalik, managed to get him, and Mike only generated $60,000 for the whole night with the guy on the table. But Mike, unlike me, Mike won 150 grand, and he was playing Baccarat for cover, and he won another $50,000 on the Baccarat table the night before the play and $20,000 that night. And he actually went into the computers, the Harris computers, as involved in a Baccarat scam. They thought that the blackjack was just cover for his Baccarat play.
Well, we're about out of time. I just want to say that, people think about blackjack computers. They think, oh, it's just a computer that counts cards. And really, all the most interesting plays were a lot more complicated than counting cards. But anyway, we encourage our listeners to send us their questions at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge. Jake, thank you again. It's been an entertaining evening.
It has. Thank you very much, Jake. Thank you, Richard.
Everyone, don't forget to buy The Battered Butterfly.
The Battered Butterfly on Amazon.com is Jake's new novel. In the meantime, go out and hit lots of royal flushes. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa. the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.